Bert Harwood, Reel 10.
Yeah, we were fortunate enough to be allocated a couple of spots to go to Assam. We went by a flat bottom boat, landing craft, navy craft to Calcutta. We eventually got on a train up to Missouri, had our fortnight's holiday, back to Calcutta and back to Rangoon on a same sort of boat. Instead of a fortnight, I had about 6 weeks, 7 weeks, because it took so long to get there. But in that time I was away is when the battalion and the company was up in these, trying to cut these chaps off. And that's where they suffered some casualties. Because although the Japs came back, they came back fighting, apparently. And I understand that there was even a bayonet charge. I never took part, but whilst I was away, this all happened. So, again, I was lucky. Anyway, I came back from the holiday, and by that time, it was more or less settled. And I rejoined my company, and I finished up at Rangoon Jail. C Company was in charge of Rangoon Jail, Japanese prisoners of war, and INA prisoners of war, the Indian National Army, the scum of the earth, as far as I'm concerned. I had to put guards on we had these Japanese prisoners of war in the cells. And I remember at one stage where a whole group of Japanese Kemptai came marching in with their old wooden truck things pulled by a horse or whatever. And they just marched into the jail, and I put them into cells. And they were big cells. There were about 20 in a cell. And it was my satisfaction in the morning to go along and rattle the old... I'd have a Japanese who could speak English, and I used to rattle the old cage, and they'd all stand up to attention. The Japanese bloke would ask them if there's any complaints or anybody ill, and we gave them. I mean, we didn't ill-treat them or anything like that. We gave them every sort of assistance. But if there's one ill, he'd see the MO. But it was really nice to rattle the old door and make them come up. And we were there for, a few weeks before I was sent home. But in that time, the INA were in one part of the jail and the Japs were in the other. And the INA, they had more or less run of the compounds. You know, they were fenced in, but they were allowed to roam around in the compound. And right in the middle of the jail was a summer house. And at this stage, they had half a dozen of these bigwigs, Indian bigwigs. They'd come in, and they started interviewing these INA wallers. They graded them, A, B, and C sort of thing. Those who were able to go home, and those who were not, and the troublemakers and what have you. One of the, must have said something to one of these INA, called him a bastard or something like that. He goes back into the compound and he stirred them all up in this compound. And I had to turn out everybody I'd got to quell them down, machine guns and everything. Those INA, they caused more trouble in that jail than the Japs did. I was always on the lookout for the bloody INA, but the Japs, they weren't in open compounds like that. They were more or less in cells, so you couldn't expect a gathering of them. But we must have treated them all right, because the old Japs, when they knew we were going to go, they gave a demonstration of the old judo. They come home with their old sackcloths and out in the open girl shelters. And they knew then that the Gurkhas were going to take over from us, and I don't think they were too pleased with it. Anyway,
with these INA, you said you thought they were the scum of the earth. Was there any other reason why you thought?
Well, why did they go over and fight for the bloody Japs? I mean, only after their own ends, I should think. I mean, our people didn't go and fight for them, and there were so many of them. I mean, they had their own flag, Kohima. At one stage, they had the old flag flying up. And they were shouting out to us in English at Kohima. No.
And at this stage, the war must have ended.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me what your reaction to the actual end of the war was?
Oh, looking forward to getting home. Because I'd got married before, and I'd got a baby son that I hadn't seen. And by then, what, he's 3 years old? Yeah. I was really looking forward to getting home. And of course, I went on the troop ship, and fortunately I came home through the Suez Canal. So, and I got home October, November time. But I know we came into... I finished up at Gravesend Barracks and got sent home on leave, and they made a cock up of my release form. They thought I was deferred regular, and they sent me a telegram to return to barracks immediately just after Christmas. And which I did, because they were going to send me to Germany. And
do you think that might have been because of your rank and the fact that you'd gone up so quickly during the war?
And funny enough, if they had sent families abroad to Germany at that time, I would have gone. I would have probably signed on. Because although I'd been through the war, and Burma was, what, 2 or 3 years, non-stop really, I mean, except the 2 leave periods and the rest period, it didn't deter me as such. I, being promoted and doing the job I was doing, I really enjoyed it. And I liked discipline. There was no chance of family going, and I hadn't seen my family. So I said, no, you've made a mistake, I'm going out. But I would have probably stopped on if the family was allowed to come to Germany.
So you had a liking for army life?
I did, yeah. I mean, I've told you about the old drill sergeant, Coldstream Guards. That period then, it really showed me what discipline was like, and during my period in Burma, I mean, at one stage we had in a rest period somewhere or other, and the division had a drill contest, and whether it was because I'd been to the guards, I was detailed to take a squad to represent our battalion, or company, whatever it was, on this parade of, and we won it. And I always say it was that training I had with the Conscription Guard. And that was only a matter of what? How long was I there for? Fortnight? Probably a fortnight. And I learned all the tricks of the trade, yeah.
And, you know, when you were Sergeant Major, did you ever have a problem enforcing discipline?
No. No. As my reference will tell you, it got on well with the men. And I feel that I did. Obviously, we had different times, we had company commander's orders. Somebody had done something wrong or fired a shot when he shouldn't have done it. You know, it's up before the company commander and your cap off, march him in. They get whatever CB confined to barracks, but I mean Attenborough, what's confined to barracks? No, yeah. But on the whole, I tried to. If they looked at my record of taking people to the company commander's office, it was minimal, because I tried to sort it out between ourselves, because it's the only way, really. And when you're in action or what have you, I mean, what's good of taking a boat to come to command? Providing they realise that they've done wrong, and most of them do.
Would other sergeant majors take it a different way?
Some would. I found that we had a one that came from the regular army. When we were at Axminster, when I was an ordinary private, we had an intake of the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry, the old regular soldiers who were recalled up, and we had one there who was a sergeant. I think he eventually got made up to come to, but he really thought he was a top hat. But he didn't get anywhere. I learned a lot through watching other people as well. Perhaps that's why I got promoted so quick, I don't know.
Would you find there would be a difference between service in, say, Great Britain, and while you were in action? Did the attitudes of officers and sergeants and the men themselves actually change to each other once you'd gone into action?
I would say yes, because everybody relies on everybody else. I mean, I've told you once about where a captain told me to move that, Kohima told me to move the ammunition. Now, I argued to toss with him about whether he was right or wrong, and I suggested to him soon after dark. He didn't take any heed of that. He sent an officer and he got killed. But in England, I wouldn't have been able to have done that. But in action, I mean, I think it's only right that you should have your opinion taken notice of, really. I mean, it wasn't always right, but in that instance, I maintain I was right, because that little stack of ammunition boxes there in the open, if it had been me on the Jap side, I would have had a fixed line on there, and anybody moving there. So at night time, to my opinion, you could have crawled in underneath there and crawled it back. Instead of going down, this poor old officer there, he just went down to the ammunition, and that was it. And I'll always blame that officer for his death, really.
By the end of the war, would you have actually said that within, say, the unit, though, the experience counted over previous regular army experience with most of the NCOs and officers?
Yeah. In peacetime or before in England. I mean, discipline seemed to come into it in a different sense. I mean, you had to turn to the left and right by numbers. When you're in action, the discipline was still there. But instead of you telling a bloke to turn left and right, say, well, let's go down here, we'll do it together, sort of thing. You know, you relied on it. Nearly every time you were two in a trench, and you relied, whether you was a private soldier with you, or whoever. I mean, being a company sergeant major, I might have a company runner in the trench with me, or I might have a signaller. But you still relied on each other. At night time, one would try and have a little kip if they could, or you would rest trying, and the other one was looking out on the alert all the time, and you relied. So the discipline is mutual for both of them, really. You're really relying on each other.
Because you did mention an incident where you were harbouring up for the night, and a soldier came back and mentioned that he didn't want to be in action anymore.
Yeah.
How did you deal with that? Because you said you took him forward the next morning. Was he on a charge or?
No. No, I could have put him under arrest. I could have put a sentry on, put him under close arrest when he came back to me. Firstly, I never had enough men to do it. Secondly, I used my loaf a little bit. I said to him, "Yeah, what are you doing?" He said, "Oh, he's had enough of it." So I said to him, "Well, look, I don't know where you're going. You can either go out into the jungle and lose yourself, or you can stop here with us and come back up with us in the morning." So he stopped with us overnight. And in the morning I took him up with the rations and what have you, and I handed him back to the company. I think it was D Company. I said, "I ran across one of your blokes last night. He lost himself down the road." I said, "I brought him back to you this morning." And that was it. There was no charge whatsoever. Now, as you said, I could have used discipline and put him under close arrest so that he would have been really charged. You know, I mean, he could have been all sorts of things. But, because we did, not particularly our company, but on occasions, there was people that done a bunk. And that, funny enough, they were picked up in different parts of the country, and you would eventually hear that they were caught, brought back under close arrest, court-martial, and what, don't know really what happened to them, whether they get a jail sentence or what. I mean, this was all, they would go back, they probably got what they wanted, they got took back out of action. But that chap who you were talking, I eventually met him at a battalion reunion at Maidstone. And he come up to me and said, "Sergeant Major Harwood." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Perhaps you don't remember me." And he told me his name and what happened. And he said, "Thank you for saving my life." And I did, really. You know, it's quite something, really.
So you'd finished back in England. Can you tell me about the demobilisation process you had to do?
I came back to Gravesend, and I'd leave, and eventually I got recalled and found out their mistakes. I got my demob number, and I went to Guildford to be demob. But funny enough, I caught malaria. I had malaria at Gravesend, and I had to go into Dartford Hospital. for a couple of weeks, and had the old course of quinine and mepocrine and what have you, before I was actually demob, and I missed my demob number because of that. But when I came out of hospital, I got sent to Guildford and demobbed. And in that time, being a gardener before the war, my old head gardener, I'd seen him during my leave period, and he said, oh, what are you going to do after the war when you come home? And I said, I haven't got a clue. I don't really want to go back into gardening, because I thought my experience and that I could do something better. And he said, well, he said, next door, he's looking for a gardener. There's a bungalow there, you know, living accommodation. So I had to work with my wife and that. And eventually I took this job, because only because it's somewhere to live. And I stopped there for 3.5 years. And but the demob, we went from Gravesend to Guildford, got issued with our grey suit and what have you, and sent home by train. No, it's everybody was quite happy to go home, I think.
And did you have a problem settling down after all that? You've been halfway around the world. Did you have a problem settling down to civilian life after you've been in the army?
Well, I wasn't. As I said, if things had been right, I think I would have signed on. Because the army, peacetime army, I think I would have enjoyed. Wasn't too bad in the war anyway. But I wasn't happy going back to gardening, although I was my own boss and what have you. It mainly to be with the family that I took that job. But then eventually, the person who was employing me lost a lot of money, sugar plantations in abroad, they lost a lot of money, and he had to cut down on the staff, and they were going to sell up, and I had to find another job. So I'd done two jobs. I went on the buses as a conductor. But all the time, the people there, they allowed me to stop in the bungalow for a 12-month, rent-free. I never paid any rent anyway. It was all part and parcel of the job. And the wages weren't very much anyway. I went on the buses for a while, a conductor. I found that it wasn't a bad old job, bit of fun, but the fumes from the back of the bus, diesel fumes, didn't do me any good. I had a bit of sickness through that. So I left that and went on the building trade. And I was a brickie labourer for a while. And then one Christmas, we were doing repairs to a chimney on the sub-post office at Bletchingley. We'd got scaffolding up around the chimney, and we were doing the chimney, and the weather got a bit bad. We couldn't carry on with it. So the sub-postmaster said to me, he said, why don't you come down here, he said, and do a bit of delivery of letters at Christmas, he said, instead of sitting up on the air in the weather, like, you know. So I saw the governor of the building, and he was quite agreeable for us to take a week off, and I went on the post office as a temporary delivery officer. And from there on, I never went back building. I went on the post office, and I progressed through the post office.
And can I ask you what your attitude was to serving with the Royal West Kents in the Second World War?
My attitude. quite proud, really, to real proud to serve with the Raskens. It was only that the fact that I joined the TA from Westrum, or Oxford, I was living in Oxford at the time, I joined the TA at Westrum, that they were an infantry battalion. Whether I would have joined an infantry battalion if I'd had other options, you know, but it's just the fact that the West Kents was the nearest one to join, and I joined them. It might have been better to join the artillery or something or other, but no, I joined the West Kents. Had some rough times, had some good times. But on the whole, I enjoyed it.